This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. This year marks the 60th anniversary of Freedom Summer, a critical time in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, marked by hundreds of arrests, dozens of beatings, church bombings, and the murders of civil rights workers. Today, we're going to spend the hour talking about this chapter of American history, the Ohio civil rights activists who were part of the movement, and the enduring impact of Freedom Summer. Joining me now are Miami University archivist for the Walter Habegerst Special Collections and Archives, Jacqueline Johnson. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
1961 Freedom Rider David Fankhauser. Thanks for being here, David.
It's an honor. Thank you.
And Cincinnati NAACP Third Vice President, Political Action Chair, and Voter Empowerment Chair, David Whitehead. Welcome, David.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you all. Miami University is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. This year marks the 60th anniversary of Freedom Summer.
In Jackson, Mississippi, a city of 100,000 whites, 50,000 Negroes, the mayor has prepared for this summer's activity by increasing the police forces, by passing new ordinances against demonstrations, and by purchasing a steel-plated vehicle, a riot control car known locally as Thompson's Tank, named for Mayor Allen Thompson.
We are prepared to take care of any law violations, to keep down violence.
Jacqueline, take us back to that moment in 1964. What was going on with Freedom Summer?
Well, in 1964, African Americans in Mississippi were not allowed to vote. And so the struggle was, what can we do to make sure that African Americans were allowed the opportunity to vote? In Mississippi, they had the lowest number of African Americans in the country, and the highest number of African Americans in terms of people who lived there. But people were not allowed to vote in terms of the actual numbers, statistic-wise. So there was a fight in SNCC and the NAACP to help African Americans gain the right to vote.
Hmm. And David, Freedom Summer was a few years after Freedom Rides started.
That's
I
right.
know, David. Yes. This is David Fankhauser. You were Freedom Rider in 1961. Tell us about how you got connected with the movement, and just how you got involved.
I was a student at Central State College, which is unusual because it was a historically black school, but they were interested in integrating in the other direction, and I was interested in helping with that. So I was at Central State, and following the burning of the bus in Anniston and then the beatings in Birmingham and the beatings in Montgomery, Freedom Riders were injured and were not able to continue the ride. Congress of Racial Equality decided finally they were afraid somebody would get killed, and so they pulled the plug on the Freedom Rides. But students in Nashville at SNCC, especially Diane Nash, said, we've got to keep this going. And she called around, and she called Central State. And I got that call. And the next morning, I flew down and joined Martin Luther King in Montgomery.
Hmm. And you mentioned SNCC. Jacqueline mentioned SNCC. Jacqueline, tell us a little bit more about SNCC for listeners who aren't familiar.
SNCC is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And they worked with the Congress on Racial Equality Corps and the NAACP and other organizations, along with the National Council of Churches, to organize Freedom Summer. And they went across the country and they canvassed college students, mostly white, from academic institutions across the United States, and recruited them to come to Western College to take part in training sessions.
And Western College, am I remembering correctly, that was a women's college in Oxford that was later kind of absorbed into Miami University?
Western College closed in 1974, and it's now part of Miami University, yes.
Okay. David Fankhauser, you know, we talked about how you were a Freedom Rider in 1961. You got the call and answered the call after mm-hmm. some very scary and violent things had happened. What compelled you to be part of this? You were only 19 years old at the time,
right? I was 19. The straight answer is that I consider us all human beings. And I was not necessarily just fighting for the rights of blacks, but for the rights of humanity. And to get our society on a more constructive, embracing pathway. So I considered it all of our fights, right, not just for blacks.
Yeah. What kind of training did you receive?
Did you hear the pregnant silence?
Yeah.
Zero.
Ah.
They didn't have time. They called and I flew down, and I was hiding out in Ralph Abernathy's house for 4 days before enough new volunteers showed up. And so my training was sitting in Abernathy's house with meetings with Martin Luther King and Shuttlesworth. And it was a very exciting time. But I hear stories that later on the training was much more intense, but I had no training.
Yeah. And when you say Shuttlesworth, you're talking about Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth.
Fred Shuttlesworth, who I met in Abernathy's house. And then when I came back to Cincinnati, there's another Fred Shuttlesworth. No, it's not. He had moved to Cincinnati in the interim. So, yes, yeah. That Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth.
Yeah. Jacqueline, you were talking about the role Western College played. That was really when training started. Was that training for Freedom Summer? Was that some training that happened later for Freedom Rides? Tell us a little bit more about that piece of the puzzle.
Well, the original training sessions were scheduled to be held at Berea College in Kentucky. And the Board of Trustees at that college decided against the training sessions because they were afraid of the safety of the people who would be attending the sessions, the activists, and of course, the volunteers. So at the last minute, SNCC and CORE contacted Western College for Women to see if they could host a training in Oxford, Ohio. And of course they said yes. And so the training sessions came to Oxford. The first day of training was June 14th. The last day of training was June 27th.
And what year is this you're talking about? I apologize. What year are we talking
1964.
About? 1964.
Okay. June 14th to June 27th, 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to just bring some information to you. So there were three parts to training. The activists trained in how to register voters, but they also were trained in how to work in community centers and also teach in freedom schools.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about freedom schools.
Well, freedom schools were they in Mississippi, because the educational system was so poor for African Americans, they thought that they should teach teachers how to use African American materials in schools across Mississippi that focused on African American history. And so they had students who were already education majors across the country in their respective colleges. And they came to Western. I think the first week was for the teacher training, and they focused on how to teach Black history to students. And then they left after the first week, went to Mississippi, and they just opened schools and churches, community centers, different places throughout the state of Mississippi to focus on African-American history, because the poor educational system was not really up to par for students of color at that time.
We're talking today about the impact of 1964's Freedom Summer and its enduring legacy. Do you have memories of Freedom Summer or thoughts about the changes it spurred? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. David Whitehead, you're with the Cincinnati NAACP. We're talking about history and the importance of this training that happened before Freedom Summer. How does that relate to the training that you all maybe do today when it comes to voter registration and those kinds of activities that the NAACP is so heavily involved in?
That's a great question. There's a lot of that corresponds and continues with what we're doing today because of the fact that there are always new rules put in place. And as the speaker said, when you were first announcing that there are new ordinances put in place, so to redirect people from what they were doing. Right now, we still have that. It's still going on. We still have to continually teach people on how to register to vote. We have to teach people how to fill out absentee ballots. There's so many different things that are necessary that are for us to educate people on so that they are not dismissed from the voting process. So, yeah, it continues. It's constant.
60 years later.
60 years later.
And before, you know, as Freedom Summer was ramping up, the murders of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner really brought national attention to these voting rights efforts in Mississippi. David Fankhauser, again, this was a few years after you'd been there for your Freedom Ride, but how did, in your view, how did their deaths affect the work that summer?
Well, it was a sea change, really. And one of the things I want to point out that the Freedom Rides and the sit-ins and the bus boycott, these are all in urban settings. And although it was dangerous, when you go out into rural Mississippi with an integrated group trying to register blacks, that's very dangerous. I mean, extremely dangerous, obviously. And so
and that's what these three young
that's
men
what
had
they
done,
did.
Right?
And mm-hmm. and the thousand there were 1,000 people that volunteered to go for this project, and every single one of them is tremendously courageous for that activity. But after they disappeared, and it was almost obvious that they had been murdered, of course. This might sound familiar. The local press said it was just a hoax. That they were just trying to make press, but they were hiding out someplace. Well, they did find them weeks later, buried in the earthen dam. Mm. They found their burned out car immersed in a swamp lake. And then, yeah. Oh.
Jacqueline, how did that? I mean, was that a part of the timeline that really jump-started Freedom Summer? I mean, did that give people more reason to really get involved in this movement?
Of course it did. You know, the deaths focused national, international attention on what was going on in the South. And so James Chaney and Michael Schwerner and Andy Goodman, through their deaths, which was sad, we focused the nation's attention on the injustices of segregation.
Right.
David Whitehead, how have the NAACP and other organizations built off of the efforts of freedom riders like David Fankhauser and the work of Freedom Summer? We talked about how that training, that education is still so important today, but what are some of the other ways that your organization has really built off that legacy?
So one of the major ways is understanding that we have to get into the communities, and we can't sit behind the desks and try to make movement within the community. So we've been going out and doing reach out, you know, events with different community members and incorporating the different aspects of helping people understand why their vote matter, why everything that affects their life is based upon their actions as they go to the ballot box. There are all different levels of connectors with people as they mark their vote, as they choose who's going to represent them. And the fact that there's collaboration, the Freedom Riders, as David is saying, is mixed up of different races. It's not just black people fighting for the rights for everybody. And when we all collectively come together and fight, we are way more powerful than we do it individually. So we have to make sure that people understand that it took everybody. And it, unfortunately, in the black community, there has always had to been someone that died for change to happen. This event had people dying. Every big movement within our nation, unfortunately, has come as a result of a death of somebody black.
You know, you were talking about the importance of getting into the community, building those relationships, building that trust. And as I was reading up on Freedom Summer to prepare for this conversation, that was something that, you know, the lead organizers talked about. You've got to make people know that they're not just a number, that you're not just counting on their vote, that you care about them. Is that, I imagine that's still just as important today.
It's absolutely just as important. We actually just launched a new chapter in one of the universities, because that youth movement that was part of this Freedom Summer of the college students are so pivotal in making sure that that age demo is activated. They're the physical people that can get out there and move the needle. So we have to make sure that they're involved, their voice is heard, and everybody's voice needs to be a part of what we do.
Yeah. David Fankhauser, you know, you had this experience as a freedom rider in 1961. There were very violent things that had happened before you volunteered for that. I imagine even after you were back in college, you were following all this news very closely.
Absolutely.
What was your reaction to these murders when you found out these three men?
It was shattering, really, and heartbreaking. And I identified so closely with them, and I felt it was, I took it personally. But I also, as David W. said, that that is the kind of thing that moves the needle, that people pay attention. Honestly, the Freedom Rides didn't receive much press until they firebombed the Greyhound bus. And those pictures went around the world, and fortunately nobody died, only because there was an undercover policeman that forced them to let the door open. Mm-hmm. But around, it was headlined around the world. And so that kind of tragic a turn of events is what focuses people's attention.
And again, the bodies of those three civil rights workers were found buried in an earthen dam near Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964.
Right.
Just tragic.
Weeks later.
Mm. Well, we are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about Freedom Summer in 1964 and its impact on the civil rights movement of the 1960s. My guests are Miami University archivist for the Walter Habegerst Special Collections and Archives, Jacqueline Johnson, 1961 Freedom Rider, David Fankhauser, and Cincinnati NAACP Third Vice President, Political Action Chair, and Voter Empowerment Chair, David Whitehead. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. Looks like we have a caller on the line. Hi, Jean. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you. I am a graduate of the Miami, Western of Miami, and I wanted to let people know that the final reunion of the Women's College is happening this weekend, right now. And there is a monument to the training, the Freedom Summer Training, right across from the main administration building. And it's got a really cool set of benches, like semicircular. It's a very community-oriented monument.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I've met some of these ladies, and they are just amazing. Western used to be, the previous version was very into international relations and international students and diversity and civil rights.
Yeah.
And we continued that with the Miami version. So I just wanted to say that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jean. I sure appreciate that. Such an important legacy there. Thanks for that call. David Whitehead, looking back to what happened all those years ago, the work you're doing now with the NAACP, what progress has been made over 60 years?
The progress that has been made has been mainly more opportunity for people to actually be in elected positions. And I say that halfway because of the gerrymandering that's going on in many of the states, including Ohio. But previously, it was unheard of during the Freedom Summer that, you know, you would have blacks, coloreds, whatever you call, we were called at that time, in political positions to affect change. Now we have the opportunity to affect change, and we just have to get more people voting to put the right people in place that would affect that change that benefits the community.
Yeah. David Fankhauser, what do you think? I mean, you were a freedom rider in 1961. You have been following this very closely, obviously, ever since. What do you think about what progress has been made?
Well, if you consider where we started, that was an extremely low bar. And there's no doubt about that we're much better place now than we were. But it is disheartening to me to see we made major progress with the Voting Rights Act. And got a lot of the – we got blacks registered. We got them voting. We got some blacks elected to office. Of course, they can still corrupt this, a what should be a democratic system into one that is a pale semblance of what democracy really is, because we know that Ohio's about 50, 55% Democratic voters, but you have Republicans that are – have control of all of the houses. So we're far from being a well-functioning democracy, but in the last 4, 5, 6 years, we're backsliding terribly, and there's all kinds of move being taken to try to restrict voting, not just blacks, but also of poor whites, and to give the wealthy greater power in this flawed democracy. And I think we're going to talk about some of those steps. But it reminds us of the bad old days when there were poll taxes, there were literacy tests, there was property ownership tests. And if you didn't pass all those, nobody could vote. Well, they're not. It's not that blatant now, but they've come up with new ways to restrict the ability to express your voice in this democracy.
David Whitehead with the NAACP, what are your thoughts? Has the country lost ground, maybe not since 1964, but in recent decades? Have we lost ground in the United States, especially when it comes to voting and voting rights?
We have. We have. Just on the mere fact that they're reducing the number of hours for early voting, they are putting restrictions in regards to drop boxes that adversely affect those that don't have the ability to have transportation and work daytime hours. You know, they're limited locations. We now have the new ID laws, that can restrict you from being able to vote without having, you know, the state and government IDs. So those that have the inability to pay, we had to put some people in place in order to help them obtain that identification. Now, if you don't have a birth certificate and you don't have your Social Security card, it's kind of hard to obtain that. And there are many people that just are transient people that don't have that type of information. So that further delays and restricts their opportunity to be able to have a voice in the vote.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned people who may not have a birth certificate, people who may not have, you know, that Social Security card. That's people of all races. I mean, that affects
Correct.
Everybody. You were talking about lower
Correct.
Income people. Right. People have to move, get evicted. That's mm-hmm. something that affects a lot of people, certainly. Jacqueline, how important was the black vote during the civil rights era of the 1960s once this increased registration and this push on voter registration was really taking hold?
Well, I think it was really important. If you look at today, there are about 34 million African-American voters, African-Americans in the United States. So I think it was important for us. But I think one thing that I think that we need to recognize is what my two colleagues just stated. We need to continue to put pressure on our politicians to make sure that voting is easy. It shouldn't be difficult or confusing.
Well, I know people who, I will say, just to make sure this gets out there, that the lawmakers who support those laws say they're trying to protect against fraud and they want to make voting secure. So I want to make sure we voice that because that's what they say. David Whitehead with the NAACP, you're giving me a look like, I can't believe those words just came out of your mouth. What do you say about that?
I don't disagree with you. There is a reason to be able to state that. But when you start looking at the factual and the research, none of it is justified through research. There have been many court cases where they've tried to find that this was this abundance of fraud. So we're trying to fix something that's not broken. And we're making it harder for people to vote by doing that.
Amen.
And that's where the problem is.
Yeah. David, let's keep talking about this. How strong is the push from the NAACP, other organizations, to get people to vote this year? And how big a concern is it that people will sit out the election?
I'll start with the second question. There's a huge concern that people will sit out the election. One of the problems that we had in the state of Ohio was the fact that the presidential candidate was not on a ballot. And, you know, we know that some people only vote during presidential elections. We also have a big number of purge people in Ohio. So that is a concern. And then the other one is people have just lost their hope and because of a lack of information and a ton of disinformation. This is an era where there's so much bad information coming out that you can't filter in the good information. So we have taken an active role in trying to make sure we go to the people. We were fortunate enough in our unit here in Cincinnati to be the first of its kind to have a mobile unit where we actually have 6 computer stations inside a mobile unit that we go into communities, we go to events, and we give people the opportunity to register to vote or check their voter identification and make sure that they're voting at the right precinct or make sure that they're actually active in their voter database. Because that's important when we get there to the poll and people find out UC has a University of Cincinnati has a very big problem with their students going to vote at a polling location and that's not their polling location. Mm. So guess what happens? They don't vote.
Right.
Yeah.
So we need to make sure that we keep people informed and we are very charged in regards to making that happen.
How many people have you been able to kind of touch through that outreach in terms of getting them registered, helping them clarify where they should vote, all that?
That is a great question. We have had numerous events so far. I think we're up to probably about 300 registrations. We've got about at least 75 address changes. And that's just only with doing a couple of events. Now, we have a ton of events this summer, and we hope to move 10% up increase in voter registration. And then with the information that we're collecting, we hope to have at least 20% of voter activity after registration, because that's a problem. We have people registering, but then they miss the step of voting. Hmm. I don't need you just to register. I mean, great, we want you registered, but we actually want you to vote and cast, let your voice be heard.
Yeah. Well, because if you register and don't vote, you know, we've talked about how a number of states, including Ohio and Kentucky, have passed these new voter ID laws, along with efforts to purge the rolls of people who are maybe registered but haven't voted for years. I want to start with you, David Fankhauser, just because you've lived so much of this, what we're talking about, all these movements in the 1960s. What impact do you think those laws could have on voter turnout? I mean, you've been a kind of observing this. You've been a student of this for a long time now.
Well, I'm not sure what laws you're talking about. The new laws that they're passing are restrictive, and I think those will have a major impact. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the Voters' Rights Act of 1965 had a major impact on improving the Black participation in the Democratic. By the way, I want to just mention, because people often say, well, how successful was XY movement? And if you look at the number of registrations from Freedom Summer, they've assisted 17,000 blacks to attempt to register, and they were successful with 1,600.
Oh, my goodness.
Less than 10%, because that's how serious the barriers were to registering. So one could look at that and say, well, Freedom Summer was not successful. On the contrary, it gave the impetus for the next year for this major legislation to be passed to guarantee the rights of all Americans to vote. So yeah, it was very successful in a holistic sense. But if you look too closely at the actual numbers, mm-hmm, it was less than what we had hoped for.
Yeah. David Whitehead, I want to talk to you a little bit more about this. These new voter ID laws you referenced, the purging. I mean, what kind of impact does all that have on the work you're doing to try to encourage people get registered, vote? I mean, do you hear from people that that's a barrier?
You hear from people often. So we do an event every month with in conjunction with the reentry program, which are people returning home, citizens from incarceration, and they are excited. They're happy that in the state of Ohio, once they've been adjudicated, they can actually vote. Right. But you hear, I don't have identification. I don't have the money to get identification because I don't have employment yet. So we've been working with other associations in order to get the funding for those identifications to help them get that ID so that they can go register to vote.
We are talking this hour about Freedom Summer, and we are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking this hour about 1964's Freedom Summer, the impact it had on the civil rights movement of the 1960s, and the impact it continues to have today. My guests are Miami University Archivist for the Walter Havegerst Special Collections and Archives, Jacqueline Johnson, 1961 Freedom Writer David Fankhauser, and Cincinnati NAACP Third Vice President, Political Action Chair, and Voter Empowerment Chair, David Whitehead. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Right before we took our last break, we did get a call from a listener who said that, you know, we've been talking about how they are purging voter rolls and wanted to know who was purging the voter logs. I know that Democratic lawmakers have called on Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose in Ohio to restore 27,000 voter registrations that were removed from the voter rolls in late 2023. His office said that had to happen because of a limited time frame under federal law. Democrats were concerned it was a political move. When we're talking about purging voter rolls, is that what you're talking about? The secretaries of state that are doing that?
It's the secretaries of state.
Okay.
So they have a list of time in which you have to have some sort of action, whether signing on to a petition for someone to run for office, participating in any of the elections. If you don't do that within that certain time frame, then you go into a list and then they pull you off of eligibility to vote. Mm-hmm. So you have to stay active is what it is.
Yeah. We also got a call from Sue Ellen, who did not stay on the line, but wanted to add her comment about how hard poll workers work during elections to help voters. David Fankhauser, you have thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. It's a thankless job, although for decades, they were very – we go in, it was a friendly situation, and they're your neighbor, they recognize you. But now it's a life – they have their lives threatened. It's unbelievable. And I think that part of the corruption that is taking place is really fundamental in the process. And we have not only these threats made against poll workers, but we have state legislatures threatening to take over local elections if they don't like the results. I mean, it's unbelievable to me that people can even say that with a straight face, that they're – anyway, yeah, that's very serious.
Yeah. Jacqueline, what about historically? You know, David was just talking about his experience with poll workers. Has it been a difficult or dangerous job over history?
I think it has been. But think about in 1964, poll workers were trying to keep African Americans from not voting. I mean, now you have poll workers who are happy to see anybody who comes in the door who are, you know, getting threatened. But think about the Freedom Summer time when Black people could not vote. What kind of experience did they have had? They went to a precinct to try to vote. They would have been threatened.
David, Whitehead, what are you hearing from the voters you talk to? What are the major issues that are important to them right now in this election?
Well, one of the major issues, I mean, obviously, I think across the country is all about the border issue, because that's what they're hearing in the news. So they are having questions in regards to that. The other one is in regards to the economic impact of how much they're paying at the grocery store or how much they're paying at the gas station. You're hearing that. But the thing that happens is a lot of people don't understand. And they're talking about the education. You know, they're talking about the fact that funding for education. Well, and they're thinking everything from an executive level of the branch of government and not understanding that the legislative level is probably more important than that executive. Executive guy is signing off. The legislative people are the ones that are creating policy. They're signing off on budget. They're determining how much money is trickled down to the everyday citizen. So you can't just elect the president and not have people to support whatever you thought that president had in mind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of confusion out there because there's, a lot of misinformation.
Jacqueline, I know you're an archivist. You're looking at history, but what do you hear from people that you talk to about the issues that are most important to them this election cycle?
Well, the issues that are most important to, I think, everybody is the economy. I think that's an issue. I think the fact that healthcare is an issue, healthcare for everybody. I think what some of the issues are, of course, voting rights will always be an issue.
Yeah. David Fankhauser, how about you? What are you hearing from your friends and neighbors?
Well, I have to say that I think the whole thing about the economy misses really the economy is, in fact, if you talk to economists, we're in great shape. Mm-hmm. It is true there is inflation, and it is true that that's blamed on the president, which is kind of crazy. But by the same token, for me, a major problem with the inflation is if you look at the pay raises that the CEOs of the grocery stores, huge pay raises, and our wages are not going up. And the way what's going up is the profit margin for a lot of this, and it's not. So there is a problem with prices going up, but it isn't just a matter of improper administration of the economy. So I think that it's also there's a lot of misinformation that is convincing people that what's really wrong is the economy, and what they see, you know, the gas prices are high. Okay, well, that's one measure, but mm-hmm. that's not the most important in terms of the employment is fabulous. The wages are going up. Sometimes they don't go up as fast as inflation, and that does cause a problem. Yeah. But I would like to see us focus more on the issues of inequitable distribution of wealth, that the wealthy are getting far wealthier than the rest of us, and nobody's dealing with that. That's a third rail. You're not, mm-hmm. not allowed to talk about that here. But
I will say, though, to Jacqueline's point, I do think when it comes to wealthy people getting wealthier and other people not, that feels like the economy to people. I know that's not how economists talk about the economy, but when you go to the grocery store and you're having trouble paying your bill, when you go to the gas pump, I know those are all slices of the economy, but I think that's what people really feel in their day-to-day lives.
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt. Healthcare should be first and foremost. It's a tragedy, the American healthcare system. And if you look at the healthcare systems of developed countries around the world, we spend much more and do the worst job. It's because,
profit margin.
I'm going to get off that soapbox.
It always comes back to the profit margin. Yeah. So people want paybacks on their stocks. People want profit margins from a corporate level. But the little guy, you and I, well, I don't know about your financial situation, but you and I are getting crushed at the cash register so that someone can maintain their profit level.
Mm-hmm. David Fankhauser, we've talked about you were a freedom rider in 1961. When you look back and think back to that freedom ride more than 60 years ago, how do you think about the legacy of that work?
I think it's one of the most important steps that I took in my life. It's a high water mark for me. It's interesting from this perspective because we have a different, but they say, was that terrible? And, it seemed unending. But the time I spent in Parchman State Penitentiary with these wonderful, wonderful fellow freedom riders, and I felt like I was doing something really valuable. And I almost treasure that time that I spent with John Lewis and Jim Farmer and Stokely Carmichael. They were all my cell block mates.
Wow. And you ended up in the penitentiary because you all filled up the jails, right?
That was right. The first success Freedom Rides had was to fill up the Jackson City and County Jail. So then they bust us 300 miles north to Parchman State Penitentiary, the most infamous penitentiary in the South.
Well, you talk about good memories, but it wasn't. They didn't exactly treat you like five-star guests, right?
We remodel the memory, and I have pleasant memories of them. But no, they treated us terrible, terribly.
Yeah. Okay. What is the lesson that you would hope the country could learn from the Freedom Rides of 1961, David, Freedom Summer of 1964? There are so many. We've been talking about voting and mobilization and education, but what's the big lesson there?
Well, one of the things is that thank God for students. And students are the spark plug. They're the ones that really carried the Freedom Rides and Freedom Summer.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you, the students are speaking out today, I'm happy to say, and thank goodness for them because they see injustice going on and they're speaking out about it, and the politicians are not paying any attention to them, so the students are going to keep talking. And I praise the Lord for that, and students, keep it up.
Jacqueline, what do you think? What do you think are the big lessons that you would hope our country could learn from these, historic times, this historic activism, Freedom Rides and Freedom Summer?
Well, I think the legacy of Freedom Summer is about what one of the speakers said earlier about college students not giving up. But I think if John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael were with us today, I think they would encourage us not to give up and not to lose hope.
That's right.
And we've gotten a couple of questions about voting and how to register for vote. If you want more information, you can get that at the League of Women Voters website or by looking up your local board of elections. Or you can look for that NAACP van that's going around, right?
That's right.
David Whitehead with the NAACP, what do you, when you think about the legacy of Freedom Summer, these freedom rides, what do you think that legacy is?
Well, I think the legacy is that the community takes ownership of the movement, that you have to be involved. You're going to be involved one way or another, whether you're on the sideline or in the front lines. And I appreciate David for being in the front lines. He's got a great T-shirt on that says, "Good trouble, necessary trouble." We need to get in that necessary area, where we understand that we need to be out there. And that's what I take from that, is that they understood the charge and they went and made it happen. Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to continue to do. The fight is just different. It didn't stop. It's just different.
We got an email from Nicholas. Nicholas writes, "I was an election worker in New York for 11 years before I moved to Ohio. What can I as a citizen do to affect change locally and statewide on this very important issue?" Do you have thoughts on that, David Whitehead?
Yes. Call 513-281-1900 to NAACP and come volunteer with me. We'll get out there. That's how you can affect change. We need to get out to the community.
Okay. Jacqueline, why do you think the activism of the 1960s continues to inspire today's activists?
Because it gives us a pattern of what we can do. We use that as an example of how we can make progress in today. So keep in mind, in Mississippi, African Americans were not allowed to vote. And you had, and so SNCC and CORE went throughout the country and recruited students to come to Western College to learn about how to register voters, work in community centers, and also to teach in freedom schools. I think it serves the model of how we can continue to struggle and to fight, but also how we can advance the voting by using what they did in the history or in the past for the present.
What do you think, David Whitehead, with the NAACP?
So we're a nonpartisan organization, which is the same similar aspect that the Freedom Summer was built on. It's just a collection of people coming together for the rights of equality for everybody. That's all we're asking for. We're asking for everybody to get the equal chance to be able to be represented and to have a voice in the process. Now, equal, when I say equal, there has to be some equity involved because there has been so many roadblocks that are barriers to the African-American community that, you know, equal isn't equal. There has to be some equity where we're brought to the table, you know, with that same type of opportunity that other people had that we didn't.
Yeah. What do you think, David Fankhauser? It's been more than 60 years since you took that freedom ride. Why do you think that activism continues to inspire people today?
Well, I think actually Diane Nash, that I'm still in touch with, said that people don't realize when they study history, they study generals and they study wars and they study, but the citizens can make history. And the citizen-made history is often the most profound in terms of moving society forward. I would like to just introduce one idea that I would hope people would take to heart, and that is I'm very distressed to see the polarization and the dehumanization that takes place in this society. And I hope we will take a deep breath and look for way for common ground. And we, all of us, have common ground. We're all faced with really the same life's challenges. And we have to put ourselves in other people's shoes, but try to embrace them as fellow human beings.
I've been talking with Miami University archivist Jacqueline Johnson, 1961 Freedom Rider David Fankhauser, and Cincinnati NAACP Third Vice President David Whitehead. Thank you all for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.